This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, sports fans. This is USA Today Sports on Friday, May 10th, read by Jim Groenfeld. First front page article is on horse racing by Dan Wolken, a columnist for USA Today. After Derby, stakes at risk. Preakness skip trend is a warning for racing. Despite much of the gloom and doom that bubbles into the narrative anytime horse racing takes a national stage, last weekend was an undeniably good one for the sport. Television ratings for the 150th Kentucky Derby were the best since 1989, with a peak of more than 20 million people tuning in to watch the thrilling three-horse photo finish with Mystic Dan beating Sierra Leone by a nose. The Derby drew a record $198.3 million in wagers, with nearly $320 million bet in total on the 14-race card at Churchill Downs. And perhaps most important of all, the week went off without any breakdowns or horse deaths, which might be coincidence, but could also be evidence that new federally mandated safety protocols implemented over the last year are working. We'll see. The bottom line is that despite racing's decline as a major mainstream sport, people still like watching and betting on horses, particularly around days that feel like big events. But the elation surrounding Derby Day is about to again run into the sport's annual come down, the Preakness. That's not a shot at the race itself, or even the notoriously dilapidated condition of Baltimore's Pimlico Racecourse. More on that in a moment. If horse racing were optimized to retain the interest of those 20 million who watched last weekend, the Preakness would be where all the storylines people learn about in the Derby end up converging. Can Mystic Dan do it again and set up a possible triple crown? How will Sierra Leone bounce back from a heartbreaking defeat? Will there be redemption for beaten favorite Fierceness? Instead, it's possible none of the main characters from the Derby will show up in Baltimore, including Mystic Dan, whose trainer, Ken McPeak, has been noncommittal to the point of seeming unenthusiastic about turning around just 2 weeks later for the Preakness. I ran him back once in 2 weeks, and it completely backfired on me, McPeak told reporters Sunday, so we'll just watch him, and we'll probably take it up to the last minute. Though McPeak's tone was a bit more optimistic on Wednesday, it's not hyperbole to suggest that the Preakness becomes a sporting irrelevance if Mystic Dan doesn't show up. And it would be the second time in 3 years the Derby winner has skipped the second jewel of the Triple Crown, following Rich Strike's absence in 2021. Regardless of McPeak's decision, the days of horsemen automatically sending their Derby winners to Baltimore appear to be over. They're sending the Triple Crown a message. Maybe it's time the sports stakeholders listen. For at least 15 or 20 years, as horses run fewer races and trainers prefer to give them more time in between to recover, spacing out the Triple Crown races has been a hot topic within the industry. It became especially in vogue to bring it up during the 37-year Triple Crown drought after affirmed in 1978, with 13 horses subsequently winning the first two legs and then coming up short in the Belmont. But American Pharoah in 2015 and Justify in 2018 proved that the Triple Crown was still possible, reinforcing the idea that it should be really, really hard to join one of the most exclusive clubs in sports. For a few years, at least, talk of changing the format waned. The question, though, shouldn't be whether the Triple Crown is too hard or too easy to win. It should be what can best sustain interest in a sport that doesn't have many big days on the national stage. Is it good for the sport that Todd Pletcher and Chad Brown, who usually come to the Derby with multiple contenders, go back to New York and wait for the Belmont? Is it good for the sport that, as of now, the only Derby horse who seems likely to run in the Preakness, is 17th place finisher Just Steele. Is it good for the sport that we could regularly have Derby winners waffling about whether it's worth trying for the Triple Crown? Though the number has always fluctuated a bit year to year, the 20 Preaknesses run between 1994 and 2013 include an average of 5.45 horses from the Derby. Over the last 10 years, however, that number has dropped to 3.6. Last year, only Kentucky Derby winner Mage ran in both races, and the rest of his career was plagued by physical problems until he was retired last November, having only run twice more after the Triple Crown. Although every horse is different, and some handle a rigorous schedule better than others, this is why trainers have increasingly leaned toward being conservative. If they want a fresh, fit horse for big races in the summer and fall, it just doesn't make a lot of sense anymore to send them out for a 1 3/16 mile race just 14 days after a hard 1 1/4 mile race. In talking with reporters Wednesday, McPeak even brought up the example of his first Derby starter, Tejano Run, who finished second in 1995. 2 weeks later, the horse finished a dull ninth at Pimlico and wasn't heard from again until the following year. As a young trainer, I wish I could have a do-over, McPeak said. I wouldn't have run him. There's lots of blame for this state of affairs, starting with a breeding industry that has evolved American racehorses into a weaker, less sound animal. But pining for the days of Count Fleet and Whirlaway, who each ran in and won a race between the Preakness and Belmont in the 1940s, isn't going to change these trends. And Pimlico is the one paying the price, which is crucial at the moment, given that the state of Maryland is set to assume ownership of the track as part of a legislative proposal that would direct $400 million in state bond money to rebuild it and make it the year-round home of Maryland racing. Without those major upgrades, the future of the Preakness being a Baltimore event would be very much up in the air. Though Maryland legislators will call it economic development, it's also a significant bet on the Preakness. But if the Preakness is no longer a race that the owners and trainers of the top three-year-olds care about, how can you justify pouring that kind of money into it? For the sake of the race itself, and sustaining any type of interest in the Triple Crown, it's time to finally think about spacing the races a month apart. If you ran the Derby on the first Saturday in May, the Preakness on the first Saturday in June, and the Belmont on the first Saturday in July, there's no doubt more horses would run in all three. They should seriously consider it, McPeak said. What's the big deal in shifting a little bit? It would be better for the sport. Of course, it would require Pimlico and the New York Racing Association working together to align the dates. Television networks would also have a say. Nothing in horse racing changes quickly or easily. But the willy or won'ty drama around Mystic Dan's participation is a flashing neon sign for a sport that should be riding the momentum of an epic Derby weekend. The Preakness, and thus the Triple Crown, is in real trouble of maintaining its relevance. There's a solution that would be better for both fans and the health of the animals. It's time for horse racing to ditch tradition and do the obvious thing to fix one of its most valuable brands. Next front page article is Major League Baseball by Gabe Locke, who writes for USA Today. Keeping pace on numbers game. Early eye-opening hitting, stealing, winning, and losing feats worth tracking till October. It's almost hard to believe, but on Wednesdays, the Padres passed the 40-game mark, putting roughly a quarter of their regular season in the books. Almost every MLB team will cross that threshold this week. With that in mind, it's certainly not too early to dope out what's real, what's fake, and what's sustainable among the wild and wonderful early paces. Check back in October to see if these spring sprints turned into autumn actuality. The stats and records shown are through Wednesday. First, Shohei Ohtani, 46 homers, 108 extra base hits. Hey, where else to start this exercise? Ohtani has astounded his Dodgers teammates, who saw plenty of his act when he was down the road in Anaheim, yet did not fully grasp his capabilities, even as a one-way player, until he was decapitating baseballs from every square of the strike zone. Even after going homerless in his first 8 games as a Dodger, Ohtani remains on pace to equal his career high of 46 homers, set in his first American League MVP season of 2021. That mark is in jeopardy. The weather will only get warmer. Ohtani's comfort level with his new team will grow, and he'll be further removed from the most distracting moments of a gambling fraud scandal perpetrated by his former interpreter, which disrupted the start of his season. But the extra base total is astounding. Babe Ruth holds the record with 119 in 1921, when he played 152 games. There have been 13 seasons of 100 extra base hits, and 8 of those came in 1937 or earlier. The only 5 since 1948 came in the heart of the offense-fueled steroid era. Ohtani's pace would put him 3rd all-time, behind Ruth and Lou Gehrig, and break Barry Bonds' National League record of 107, set in his 73-homer season of 2001. Come October, a 5,100 season, home runs, extra base hits, is within reach. Next, 100-win teams. Phillies, Dodgers, Orioles, Yankees, Guardians, Braves. Sound almost impossible? Sure. In fact, it challenges mathematics' possibility that 6 teams could win 100 games in a season. But there's no projecting the arc of a season. And right now, 2024 looks like a pair of sizable clumps at the top and a bottom and a thick middle. As recently as 2022 and 2019, 4 teams won at least 100 games, and last year 3 times won 100 and another 99. The scary thing about most of this year's sextet tracking toward a hundo is almost all of their foundations are deep and dominant starting pitching. Take the Phillies. An uncharacteristically blazing start gives them a majors best 26-12 record. They merely need to play 598 ball to hit 100 wins, and with a starting rotation so good that Spencer Turnbull and his 1.57 ERA get relegated to the bullpen, it's extremely challenging to win a series from these guys. Tyler Glasnow and Yoshinobu Yamamoto are exceeding the Dodgers' expectations, and soon they'll add Clayton Kershaw's return on the heels of Walker Buehler's debut. Orioles starters just tossed 22 consecutive scoreless innings and now roll 6 deep. Gerrit Cole is ramping up for the Yankees. Get the idea? Come October, at least 4 will pass 100 wins. And that's partly because of the 100 loss teams: White Sox, Rockies, Marlins, Astros, and Angels. It's startling to think the White Sox at 9-28, Rockies at 8-28, and Marlins at 10-29 are this bad before selling off parts of the trade deadline, to the extent that they have pieces to sell now that Luis Arias is a Padre. It's safe to assume these teams' personnel will get worse and the depth even thinner. And that makes it awfully hard to imagine that White Sox morphing from a 243 team to the 437 squad they need to avoid 100 losses. Go ahead and chalk up 100 L's for the Rockies and Marlins, too. The Astros haven't lost 100 games since 2013, and the Angels never have. Come October, the Astros recover from their 343 pace, but too late to keep their dynasty going. The Angels also avoid 100 losses, but find themselves dueling with Oakland for 4th place. Next up, Ellie De La Cruz in the 30-90 club. Might as well get used to it. MLB's liberal stolen base rules will produce wild seasons that look like statistical anomalies. Ronald Acuna Jr. tested the plateaus last season, when, to great fanfare, he became the first member of baseball's 30-homer, 60-steal club, and eventually the charter member of the 40-70 club. So long as there are five-tool marvels brightening the baseball landscape, we'll continue witnessing unprecedented statistical permutations. This year, it's Ellie De La Cruz's turn. The Reds shortstop entered the baseball zeitgeist with a fabulous start to his career in 2023, before tailing off, as many 21-year-olds do. He's charting a similar course this year, with 6 homers and 10 steals in his first 19 games, and 2-11 in the 17 games since. Yet that still puts De La Cruz on a 37-homer, 95-steal pace, which would be the most bagged since Vince Coleman swiped 107 in 1987. Come October, 30-80 looks realistic, but De La Cruz is still growing as a player, and any bid at 40-80 would be threatened by even a brief power outage. And then Marcell Ozuna, 181 RBIs. Sure, the run batted in doesn't have nearly the cachet it once did, scorned as a product of opportunity. Well, you got us there. See, Marcell Ozuna bats fifth for the Atlanta Braves and is asked only to serve as designated hitter, and simply waving bat at ball is likely to send a few of his teammates toward home plate. The Braves remain in their prime and have been largely healthy, which means Ozuna comes to the plate after Acuna, Ozzie Albies, Austin Riley, and Matt Olson precede him. That's 11 All-Star appearances and 9 Silver Sluggers filling the base pass. Ozuna has responded in kind, with the major league leading 38 RBIs in just 34 games. His projected 181 RBIs would rank 4th all-time, just 10 shy of Hack Wilson's 94-year-old record, and make him the first to drive in at least 150 runs since Alex Rodriguez in 2007. Phillies third baseman Alec Bohm has been nearly as hot, with 32 and 37 games, a 136 RBI pace. Hardly a surprise, Bohm has batted 4th or 5th for the potent Phillies. Come October, Ozuna cracks the 150 RBI club, and the Braves and Phillies engage in another playoff showdown. The last front page article is on the WNBA by Lindsay Schnell, who writes for USA Today. Optics, timing problematic as WNBA goes full charter. 28 years after it should have happened, the WNBA announced Tuesday that it would charter to all regular season games starting as soon as next week, giving the best women's basketball players in the world something they earned long ago, but is often not acknowledged by their superiors. Respect. The news gives that old saying, better late than never, new meaning. Most of the time when someone says that, they don't think late is going to be in reference to nearly 3 decades. There is a historic move for the WNBA, according to League Commissioner Kathy Engelbert, a huge step for a league that often acts like a startup instead of a major player in the sports landscape. And while overdue, it's a win. Players are downright giddy knowing they'll be able to recover quicker after road games, and do so while prioritizing their privacy and safety. As WNBA agent Lindsay Kagawa-Kolas, who represents numerous top players, told USA Today Sports, this is a great example of when doing the right thing for player health and safety is good for business. Bottom line, this is good news. But it's also worth pointing out that the optics of this decision and its timing are terrible, and optics matter. From the outside, it certainly looks as if the league suddenly decided to start chartering full-time due to the arrival of a popular white player in Caitlin Clark, when last season, the safety of a black player, Brittany Griner, wasn't enough to create permanent change. On Tuesday, Engelbert insisted it's more nuanced than that. She told the media the popularity of the 2024 draft class is not what drove this decision. She's been working on getting charters since she took over as commissioner in July 2019. She estimates that it will cost the league $25 million to charter full-time. You need that long-term revenue model, she said, and we haven't had it. Women's basketball is experiencing an unprecedented surge in popularity right now, led in large part by the frenzy surrounding Clark. With Clark's entry into the league last month, chartering in the WNBA had again become a major talking point. WNBA players have fought for years for charter flights, commonplace in nearly every other professional league, and been told they didn't have the money. It wasn't a priority. It wasn't a necessity. These were excuses in my mind. The WNBA, for better or worse, is financially backed by the NBA, a $10 billion entity that could have paid for charter flights from day one if it wanted. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver has always had the power and opportunity to get involved. For years, seems to me he chose not to. To say it wasn't a priority was also a low blow, as players were forced to pick between respectable salaries and charter flights during the last collective bargaining negotiations. As for it not being a necessity, Griner would surely beg to differ. For years, I've had conversations with players, agents, and power brokers about the optics of women's basketball at both the professional and college level. People have been especially critical of the WNBA, which players it chooses to promote versus not, how it markets the league, etc. And while privately they'll let their feelings be known, Black women, who've been the foundation of this league since its inception in 1997, have been especially reluctant to vocalize these criticisms, leery of rocking the boat. When they do speak out, they're blunt. 2 years ago, two-time MVP Asia Wilson told ESPN.com, "Even though our league is predominantly Black, I think it's hard for our league to push us, in a sense, because they still have to market, in their mind, what is marketable. Sometimes a Black woman doesn't check off those boxes." In her new book, which released Tuesday and details her terrifying 10-month detainment in Russia, Griner talks about returning to the States to both fanfare and vitriol. Threats became commonplace for the 9-time All-Star and 2-time Olympian as she walked through airports with her teammates on their way to and from games. Despite major concerns about Griner's safety, no charters were provided for the Mercury or Griner individually at the beginning of the 2023 season. Previously, the league fined the New York Liberty for chartering, saying it was a competitive advantage banned by the CBA. Last June, Griner was accosted in DFW Airport by a right-wing YouTube personality, despite her security guard trying to steer him away. Police were called, the clip went viral, and fans shared their outrage on social media. While Griner was allowed to fly private at her discretion the rest of the season, separating her from her teammates, which no one liked, it never should have taken that incident to spur action. Again, players are thrilled they finally got this benefit. They were also surprised by the news. As a player that's been in this league for a while, we've been fighting for this first for a long time. Brianna Stewart of the Liberty, a 2-time MVP, said Tuesday night after playing in Chicago. So now to say that you've just come up with a 25 mil? Nothing's changed. Media deal? CBA? Nothing. You know what I mean, where you could say that money has come in. So either you were just holding on to it for whatever. But honestly, I'm happy, very happy, but surprised because I thought it was going to be used as a bargaining chip in CBA negotiations. Even if it's true that Clark wasn't the final straw, or the individual who pushed the league to finally do the right thing, for the WNBA and Engelbert to not even acknowledge that the timing looks problematic again minimizes the concerns of the Black players. It's a tough balance, said 6-year veteran Nafisa Collier of the Minnesota Lynx. It is a little bit frustrating, but I feel like that's how everything changes. You put a spotlight on things and force their hand. I'm happy something catapulted this change. In that sense, I'm happy we got to this point. But I am a little disappointed it took so long to get here. On Tuesday, when USA Today Sports asked Las Vegas All-Stars Wilson and Chelsea Gray about the charter issue, Wilson said, "If we credit this to one person, that's disrespectful to the players before us. They help us continue to push this league and push this game and grow it. I'm happy it's finally here and it's happening, because I know we were all tired of waiting for it." I'm tired, too. Tired of the WNBA repeatedly dismissing concerns from its employees. Tired of the league acting like race doesn't matter when its women of color have the bravery to speak out, even though they have the most to lose. Tired of reminding people that we must keep this conversation going, even if the charter issue itself is fixed. Tired of telling people it's okay to demand more of a professional organization that's been around 28 years. But mostly, I'm tired of the WNBA not meeting the moment. One day, maybe the league will get it right the first time. And then a little MLS soccer by Safid Dean, who writes for USA Today. The Philadelphia Union signed 14-year-old to MLS deal. Move over, Joel Embiid, Bryce Harper, and Jalen Hurts. There's a new star in Philadelphia, and he's just 14 years old. Philadelphia Union signed Kevan Sullivan to a 4-year deal Thursday, making him the youngest player in team history and the 5th youngest to sign a deal in Major League Soccer. Sullivan could become the youngest athlete to play an American professional team sport and the youngest to debut in a major soccer league if he debuts with the Union on or before July 29th. "To be totally honest, I'm a pretty boring kid outside of soccer. It's really my life," Sullivan said during his introductory press conference. "Soccer, homework, and my dad runs his training facility and I help out a lot there, but soccer's my life. It's the main thing." He'll join his 20-year-old brother Quinn, also a midfielder, on the Union MLS squad. And that concludes USA Today Sports, read by Jim Gronfeld for Radio Reading Services. Stay healthy.